good morning to those who are doing the half day morning news. We'll begin with commentary. Various organs of the press are carefully scrutinizing the trends and prospects in the development of relations between the USA and what we in Jonestown refer to as mainland China. Diametrically opposite views are being expressed in press comments and in statements by Western political figures on the real essence of these relations and their influence on the international situation. The enemies of detente and peace who urge the stepping up or escalation of the arms race and the expansion of NATO's sphere of action for anti-Soviet and anti-communist purposes favor a rapprochement, or that means a semblance of peace between the United States and China of such a kind that it would undermine the positive changes achieved during the past few years in reducing the risk of war and strengthening businesslike cooperation between states with different social systems. On the other hand, realistically minded moderate circles in the West express their anxiety over such a development of U.S.-Chinese relations because it is generally known that Peking continues strongly to oppose any moves or measures to improve the political climate in the world. There are clear signs, both in Peking and amongst circles in imperialist USA, that attempts have recently been made at state level to coordinate clearly the U.S. and Chinese policies in the pursuit of aims which are hostile to the Soviet motherland and other socialist countries of the Warsaw Treaty, the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, for instance, the Mongolian People's Republic, and really the socialist community in general. Thus, U.S. Senator Hart said after his visit to Peking earlier this year that his country should not underrate China's significance as a political and military force confronting the Soviet Union. Senator Hart, of course, does not hold any post in the U.S. administration, but what can one say about a number of anti-Soviet statements which the USA President, National Security Advisor Brzezinski made during his recent stay in Peking. He mentioned the USA and China's common interest and demonstrated his approval of those aims at Peking's foreign policy, which on a number of key issues coincide with his own views. Like the Peking leaders, this U.S. statesman, if we care to dignify him so, believes that nuclear war would not be a catastrophe for mankind. Continuing with the news, information in the foreign press shows that the Washington envoy and the Chinese leaders discussed the possibility of working out a common approach by the two countries, not only to the problems connected with the Soviet Union, the vanguard of liberation in the world, but also to those affecting Southeast Asia, Africa, and Western Europe. Washington Post observers Evans and Novak said that during these talks, the possibility of joint steps in respect to Angola, Mozambique, the Horn of Africa, and Indochina were discussed. There are many indications of this. Washington does not even bother to deny them, although the White House tries to disassociate itself from the conviction spread in the USA and in other countries that the attitude to the Peking regime of the present administration was inspired by hostile and anti-Soviet moves. In one of the most recent interviews, President Carter said that his administration would never use China as a lever against the Soviet Union, because if it did use Peking in this way, it would provoke the resentment of both the Chinese and the Soviet peoples. How, against this background, can anyone explain the behavior in Peking of the U.S. President's assistant, who we are now informed through Penthouse is actually the leader of the USA, Brzezinski, who had backed both Republican and Democrat candidates and was picked, handpicked by the Trilateral Commission to direct the foreign policy of the United States. None of this of his anti-Soviet statements made there has been contradicted. None of them have been contradicted by the U.S. government. On the contrary, shortly after Brzezinski's Chinese visit, a U.S. delegation left for Peking to discuss scientific and technical questions, including, according to the U.S. press, the possibility of delivering U.S. military equipment to China. Remember, this is Brzezinski who has promoted the doctrine of the Superman. This is Brzezinski who said to a group of reporters openly, "I must retire to talk about plans for genocide," which means racial extermination or ethnic extermination or whole extermination of parts of population. It is Brzezinski who said that to think that nuclear war is unacceptable is to be egocentric, which showed his ignorance. He should have at least said ethnocentric. It's also clearly been established that if the full delivery capability were unleashed of nuclear energy at the present race on the world, it could cause a imbalance to the very axis of the world. Peking does not even try to conceal its intentions of using the USA to promote aims directed against USSR and other socialist countries. Peking's anti-socialist propaganda and anti-Soviet propaganda campaign has become particularly strident and hysterical. The People's Daily has carried a story about the bear's claws reaching out to the gates of the United States of America. This nonsense borrowed from Goebbels, the propaganda minister of the Nazi Third Reich's arsenal of anti-communist lies, is needed by the instigators of the campaign in order to put the USA imperialists on a collision course with our beloved Soviet Union. At the same time, China itself obviously wants to keep on the sidelines so as to reap the coveted fruits of such a great upheaval. Are the architects of U.S. policy really blind to what Peking is seeking? It is, of course, impossible not to see the crudely provocative line of the Chinese leaders in matters of war and peace, that they feel that there is something to gain for China by a nuclear war, that they can survive it and somehow spread their brand of communism about the world. Everything seems to indicate that Washington is pursuing its own aims in engaging in its anti-Soviet flirtation with Peking. It is attempting to use the policy of the Chinese leadership in the interest of the United States' imperialist concern. What took place in the 1930s seems in fact to be repeating itself in different historical conditions. At that time, Western leaders tried to channel fascist aggression against the USSR. The Nazi ringleaders in their annexationist policy, relied on the West anti-communist, anti-Soviet propaganda. In that way, they cleared the road for themselves to establish control over small and medium-sized nations in Europe before moving further towards the seizure of territory. The anti-Soviet game with the expansionist forces ended catastrophically for its initiators, but the whole of mankind had to play pay a dear price for it, with a heavy toll of human lives and suffering resulting from the world's conflict unleashed in the late 1930s that may have even been perpetrated by capitalist elements, that Adolf Hitler's Germany may have been even perpetrated, according to some theorists, as a buffer against the first and greatest revolution of all history, the October 1917 Soviet Revolution. Anyway, these lessons are too tragic and grim to ignore. Now that such destructive weapons have been accumulated in the world, only irresponsible leaders who consider it possible to play with the destinies of millions of people can think of setting one state against another. It is out of place to ask, is it not out of place, I should say, to ask why high-ranking officials in Washington, who are so fond of fine words about their allegiance to moral standards, fail to take issue with the grossly negative, inflammatory, and inhuman pronouncements that are heard daily from official sources in Peking on questions of war and peace. Indeed, it is not some trifling matters which are at stake, but questions bearing on the destiny of all mankind. Washington's silence cannot but be interpreted by the Peking regime as encouragement of their monstrous theories of nuclear holocaust in their ridiculous and outdated doctrine of three worlds. Quite a few serious commentators, and indeed influential politicians, in the United States of America have been worried about what is correctly viewed as the provocative use of the Chinese card by men close to the White House against the Soviet Union and several other countries. In its issues of July 17, the U.S. News and World Report carried an article by its analyst Marvin Stone. He said, in the August issue, that is, that the Chinese leaders were always ready to give advice to others. Now, the U.S. News and World Report is a very ultra-conservative magazine in the USA. Furthermore, it is one of the few that has been revealed by elements of the social democratic and socialist and liberal press to have not had any CIA direct infiltration. Now, Marvin Stone of the U.S. News and World Report, the ultra-conservative organ, Journal of USA, said that the Chinese leaders were always ready to give advice to others. They wanted Turkey to oppose the Russians. They wanted to see the North Atlantic Treaty Organization stronger. They wanted Japan to preserve its alliance with USA, and they wanted to draw the Americans into a tangle of African conflicts. He asked whether this was good advice, reminding his readers about the statements made by Mao Zedong in 1957 concerning the permissibility of a nuclear war, a statement which has not been repudiated by the present Peking regime, who are expressing the same ideas in various forms. The magazine drew the conclusion that in its game with Washington, Peking was trying to stir up a nuclear conflict between USA and the USSR in its maximum program in its doctrine of three worlds. Such conclusions about the far-reaching provocative aims, the aims of disturbing the world peace of Peking's policy, have been confirmed by statements of high-ranking Chinese officials themselves. The Chinese Minister of Defense, Su Hsiang-chin, said in the August issue of the magazine Red Flag that war is a normal thing in relations between two worlds, and that war is a continuation of peace. Official Washington prefers to ignore these inflammatory statements, trying to whitewash the Chinese government's policy. At the end of July, for example, Jody Powell, the White House press secretary, stated that China conducting an independent foreign policy and strong and secure as far as its economy was concerned would meet the interest of the United States. These statements deliberately ignore the disquiet of those Americans who justly regard the interest of universal peace and international cooperation as of paramount importance when considering prospects for their country's relations with mainland China. Nobody is encroaching on the independence of China's foreign policy. This is well known. The question is what the nature and the trend of the policy is. The joint communique adopted by the governments of the USA and China in February 1972 stated that the confidence of both sides that the normalization of relations between their countries not only met with the interest of the Chinese and American people, but would also add to détente, that means peace in Asia and in other parts of the world. The words are very fine indeed, but the years that have passed since that adoption of this communique have shown that Peking continues to oppose any steps towards the relaxation of tensions in Asia or elsewhere for that fact. The establishment of contacts between the USA and China has in no way influenced the tough and negative policy of the Chinese leadership in their war-minded foreign policy. Nor are there any signs that Washington is in any way trying to put into practice the high-sounding words of the U.S.-Chinese communique. The USSR, the vanguard of liberation in the world, has everything necessary to neutralize all schemes and combinations hostile to it and to the cause of peace. No one in history has ever profited from taking the road of anti-Sovietism. Today, this is truer than ever. The Soviet Union is not without means of defense. We have unequivocally pointed out that forming a bloc with China on the basis of anti-Sovietism would close the possibilities for cooperation with the United States in reducing the danger of a nuclear war and limiting the arms race. Washington should give serious thought to this instead of thinking in terms of petty anti-Soviet scheming. As for the treacherous line of the Peking leadership, no matter what they are achieving domestically, which is aimed at increasing international tension, provoking crisis situation, and setting states at loggerheads, the proponents of this line have again showed the world their true face. They may receive something in material terms from imperialist reaction. It is easy to see what such incentives are meant for. These stubborn facts cannot be ignored by anyone who gives at least some thoughts to the realities of our time and the demands made of any government in the world today, where there is no more vital and important task than progress towards a peaceful and secure future. Thus ends the commentary on the dangers, the immense dangerous and short-sighted gain of the present U.S. and mainland China foreign policy. Other news. With some difficulty, we try to hear Radio Moscow, which is not as easy as we would like. The Soviet Foreign Minister, Andrei Gromyko, has arrived in Washington to meet President Carter. Earlier, the foreign minister met twice in New York with Secretary of State Cyrus Vance. The talk centered on strategic arms limitations, including a new bilateral joint treaty. Views were also exchanged on the Middle East. The representatives of the Israeli-occupied Western Bank of the Jordan have rejected the Camp David agreements. Naturally so. The Arab world is greatly consternated that Camp David summit, USA, Carter, Trilateral Commission, Israel and Egypt would be so presumptuous as to try to settle resolve the solution for the situation when territory of Lebanon was involved that had been aggressively taken over by Israel and also Jordan. It is these agreements of the Palestinians to self-determination that is coming into sharp confrontation with the USA Camp David summit. They made this statement to the United States diplomat now touring the Arab countries. The mayor of Bethlehem pointed out for the Camp David Accords guaranteed an Israel withdrawal from occupied Arab territory, restoration of Arab sovereignty to East Jerusalem. He said a comprehensive adjustment required the participation of all parties concerned, including the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Opposition to the Camp David agreements has been reaffirmed again strongly this morning by Syria, Algeria, Libya, Democratic Yemen, and even South Yemen, Jordan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And so what more can USA possibly do than to back off from this summit agreement at Camp David, which has gone against the very peace of a part of the world that they need for their economic survival? Saudi Arabia is certainly a very ultra-conservative regime, but it is highly indignant at the Camp David agreement. The United Nations Security Council has described South Africa's decision to hold elections in occupied Namibia in December as unlawful. The Council upheld the United Nations decision as called for the removal of the colonial administration of the South Africans over Namibia and the transfer of power to the liberation people through the mediation of the United Nations, that is to SWAPO, Southwest African People's Organization. The Security Council's resolution calls for setting up a group to help Namibia make the transition, that means the changeover to independence, and sending United Nations troops and observers to Namibia. The Soviet delegation told the Council it would help if the Council took effective measures to isolate and boycott the racist and fascist regime of South Africa, which has been upheld by $447 billion of U.S. aid this very year alone, $447 million correction, and several billion more of multinational corporate aid. South Africa could not survive without the multinationals of the garrison military industrial state of USA. Representatives of 28 countries and several national liberation movements have denounced the imperialist powers for their practices in Africa. They spoke in Geneva at the United Nations Convention on Human Rights. Speakers underlined that the practice of imperialism means to encroach upon the sovereignty of independent countries and the acknowledged right of the nations to self-determination. Most of the African Organization of African Unity are in opposition to U.S. practices in both Rhodesia, which is rightfully called Zimbabwe, and Union of South Africa, so-called Union of South Africa. One of the leaders of the Zimbabwe Patriotic Front, Joshua Nkoma, the nationalist, has again injected the Anglo-American plan for Rhodesia in an interview given by a correspondent from Zambia. He spoke against the Congregation of All Parties Conference. He said, that is Joshua Nkoma, that the time of peace negotiations have passed. The armed struggle alone could result in the establishment of the Zimbabwean people's power in the country. They represent 97% of the country already, and genuine independence. Now, this is the nationalist speaking, not the Marxist-Leninist ally in the Zimbabwean Patriotic Front, which, of course, as you know, is Robert Mugabe. The Zimbabwean Patriotic Front now has brought under its control all the rural areas of the country. Its troops are fighting in the immediate proximity of Salisbury. The finance minister of Mozambique has accused the Western imperialist powers of pursuing a hypocritical policy towards the racist regimes in southern Africa. Remember, testing will be without doubt Monday for all. Addressing the General Assembly session in New York, he said the Western powers are trying in Rhodesia and Namibia with the aim of perpetuating their rule. The minister pointed as an example of new colonialist maneuvering to the Rhodesian racist made by British oil companies in violation of the United Nations sanctions. Angola has signed a treaty of friendship and cooperation, as you know, with Zaire. The signing ceremony took place at the end of an official visit by Mobutu, the Zairean president, and the Angolan president, Agostinho Neto. The president led the Angolan government delegation which returned to Angola on Saturday. In Tanzania, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has closed its 10th regional conference after discussing how to increase food production on the African continent. Speakers stressed the urgency of the problem and said its solution requires all aid of social conscious-minded nations and other social reforms in every country in the world. Production of modern farm methods will have to be implemented by all peace-loving people. They also call for more cooperation between the countries in agriculture for one joint action against the pests and disease, the pestilence of various rodents, you know, and funguses and so forth. The farm minister, the agronomist ministry of Venezuela, has urged the world community to give the necessary assistance to the people of Nicaragua. We're glad for this stand of Venezuela, fighting to bring down the dictatorial regime of Somoza, which is being upheld by U.S. imperialism. Speaking at the session of the United Nations General Assembly, the agricultural minister of Venezuela said, "For over 40 years, the country has been living in conditions of terror and political assassination. In Nicaragua itself, the situation remains tense. There were new clashes between the National Guard, the secret police, and the people in Managua. Many cities have been completely destroyed by the ruthless regime of Somoza, backed by new U.S. military aid. And inside the country, near border with Costa Rica, the dictator is clamping down ruthlessly. Somoza is on the participants of the recent uprising. Arrests and executions continue all over the nation of Nicaragua. Where is Mr. Carter?" Even Venezuela has said in his issue of human rights, "Where is he while the people of Nicaragua are being destroyed to save the dictatorship of Somoza?" Planes have sunk several vessels, over 300 refugees trying to leave the country. And vessels have been sunk by the planes supplied by U.S. capitalism to this merciless regime of Somoza in Nicaragua. All of the refugees died that were blown out of the water. In Chile, the Catholic Church has information from the ruling junta about the state of political prisoners whom the authorities declared missing after their arrest. According to international organizations, there are more than 2,500 such prisoners still presently. Minimal. The government has repeatedly promised the church and UN Secretary General, Dr. Waldheim, Secretary General, to provide detailed information about the missing persons in Chile, but so far has done nothing whatsoever. And again, no urging by President Carter in his so-called policy of human rights to do otherwise. Relatives of the missing say they will resume their hunger strike if General Pinochet, the military dictator of Chile, who overthrew the constitutionally elected regime administration of the great Marxist-Leninist Dr. Allende, fails to supply information in the near future. Meanwhile, the Chinese ambassador has said his government will continue to expand the cooperation with the regime in Chile. He announced that from Santiago. The ambassador, China, was speaking at the university of Santiago in Chile on the anniversary of the Chinese mainland's so-called revolution. Peking began to cooperate closely with Chile fascist junta after the legitimate Allende Marxist-Leninist government was overthrown. Trade between China and Chile has increased by several times in the past 5 years. According to Radio Moscow, the Chinese deliver largely weapons to this fascist regime. Leonid Brezhnev, president of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, has expressed his profound condolences over the passing away of the head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope John Paul I. He sent a message to the State Secretary of the Vatican. "Soviet cosmonauts are setting a new world record for staying in space 106 days. The previous world records were set last March also by two Soviet cosmonauts. The highest American record equals only 84 days. The current flight is saturated with different experiments. The cosmonauts received on board their spacecraft two international crews with representatives of Poland and Democratic Germany, the GDR, the East German Democratic Modern Communist State. Two automatic space ships with equipment, food, water, and they walked in space for 2 hours and inspected the spacecraft. They also did complicated maneuvers that no other nation in the world is able to match. They changed the link-up of the various crafts over transport ships from one fourth unit to another. Soviet specialists have designed a tractor which is operated by a small computer. It takes into account the necessities of tilling and the best speed. The computer works faster than most experienced tractor driver. The machine has been built in accordance with the government's program of completely mechanizing agricultural production. Take the burdens and work off of human beings. The country turns out annually about 15 new models of farm machinery. That is our beloved USSR. They are sold at a discount price to the collectives. The Order of Lenin and the Hammer and Sickle Gold Medal were presented yesterday to, some labor group. I'm not clear on that. They go with the title of Hero of Socialist Labor for his contribution to Soviet literature and in connection with his 50th birthday. I'm not clear on who received the award. The people of this small nationality did not even have a written language before the Socialist Revolution. When we get further clearance on that, perhaps our beloved and honored